QED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in this week for Michael Krasny. On the heels of the neo-Nazi rally gone bad in Charlottesville, with the rise of white nationalist groups gaining attention, companies like Apple, Facebook, and PayPal are taking steps to sever ties with right-wing groups. But it's raising concerns about censorship and how to balance tolerance and respect for all with rights to free speech and expression. This hour, when is censorship acceptable? And when is it that slippery slope that could silence groups you agree with? That's coming up next on Forum, right after the news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. Well, the recent rise of neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups is creating something of a dilemma for Silicon Valley. How far should companies like Facebook, Twitter, PayPal, Apple, and others go in severing ties with hate groups by denying them access to their platforms and other aspects of the Internet? Well, in recent weeks, several companies, including the ones I just mentioned, have taken steps toward blocking these groups and their messages. But now the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which defends free speech online, is urging caution in cracking down on hate groups, saying it's a slippery slope. Joining us now to talk about the limits and wisdom of censorship online is Cindy Cohen. She's Executive Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Good to have you here.
Good morning.
Also with us here in the studio is Hannah Kushla. She's a tech reporter with the Financial Times. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And joining us by phone is Jonathan Vick. He is Associate Director for Cyber Hate Response with the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL. Jonathan Vick, good morning to you as well.
Good morning.
Let me begin with you, Hannah. If you would just kind of lay out the big picture of what's going on here and some of the questions and issues that these companies are wrestling with.
So since the violence in Charlottesville last week, we've seen big tech companies really wrestle with issues which basically come down to, what are they? Are they a public place, you know, like a park where anyone can gather and anyone can say what they like? Or are they a business who needs to listen to users and advertisers and employees, and if they're unhappy, ban hate groups from the internet? So what we saw in the week after Charlottesville was a lot of these companies take action. So some of them took actions very similar to some that they've taken before. For example, Facebook took down a lot of groups that looked like they were organizing white nationalists, and those were against their policies. But there were some cases which seemed a little bit more unusual. For example, there was this website called Daily Stormer, which is a white nationalist website that wrote some really quite disturbing things about the woman who died during the protests, and a lot of they came under pressure. The GoDaddy and Google and domain services that were hosting the website came under pressure to remove the website completely from the internet.
Pressure from who?
From users sort of mobilizing together into activist groups to say, look, we don't want to use your service if you provide services to neo-Nazis. And they have taken them down. And now this site has retreated to the dark web, where it's, you know, not reachable by any of the normal search engines.
Well, in fact, last week, Cloudflare CEO Matthew Prince, and if you could, Hannah, just describe what Cloudflare is. We want to play a cut from their CEO, but for those who don't know.
So Cloudflare is a cybersecurity company that protects websites from distributed denial of service attacks. Those are the kinds of cyber attacks that take websites completely off the internet. So they bombard them with traffic until they can't cope. So Cloudflare acts as a defense, which means that it's very, very useful. It protects 10% of the internet's traffic, but it also means it's a bottleneck where if they stop protecting you, then hackers can take your site down.
And so last week, Cloudflare CEO Matthew Prince withdrew service from that neo-Nazi site, Daily Stormer. And that was the first time the site had pulled their service on any client. And the CEO, Matthew Prince, admitted to feeling a little bit conflicted feelings about the decision. Here's a little bit of what he had to say.
It's really a deep concern if you have infrastructure companies making choices about who can and cannot be on the internet. I would sort of analogize it to the telephone company listening in on your phone calls and deciding that they don't like what you're talking about, so they turn you off.
And Cindy Cohen from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, that from a CEO who took them down from the protection that Hannah was describing. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that Matthew's exactly right. These especially deep infrastructure companies, Facebook, Twitter, people who are directly interacting with users, we might look at a little differently. But these deep infrastructure companies really shouldn't be in the position of deciding who gets to be on the internet and who doesn't. They're not competent to do it. You know, the guy who rides next to me in the BART is not really competent to make these decisions, which are often geopolitically savvy, require deep understanding of situations, not just in the U.S., but all around the world. And, you know, I've been helping organizations and groups who have faced these attempts to go what we call upstream, to go upstream to try to get them kicked off the internet for 17 years. And I will tell you that the Daily Stormer one is an anomaly. The vast majority of these kinds of situations involve people with speech that we might agree with or we might disagree with, but we don't think is so heinous. I've worked with the Yes Men. I've worked with satire groups. I've worked with oil activists, anti-oil activists. I've worked with groups all across the progressive and left spectrum, people in the middle of the road. You know, anybody who gets somebody mad at them is vulnerable to an attempt to try to go up and kick them off the internet. So I worry that a lot of the people who might be cheering this tactic now, because I have no love for Nazis. This hurts my heart. But if we embrace this tactic now against groups we hate, we're endorsing something that not only will be used, but has been used traditionally to try to silence voices that we might really love.
And when you said, you know, the guy next to you on the BART train is not competent to make these decisions, I'm not quite sure what you meant by that and who is competent.
Well, the tech companies, I'm talking about the tech workers. We're here in Silicon Valley. So the guy who sits next to me on the BART may be working at a place like Google or Cloudflare and be in a position to try to decide if someone's complaining about a group.
But these decisions are usually made pretty high up, aren't they?
No, actually. Most of these decisions in the vast majority of cases are made by people who make minimum wage, who have a little bit of training, who have a manual. Facebook's manual was just leaked and spread on the internet that they it's a low wage. Low paid workers, sometimes in the U.S., sometimes in like the equivalent of call centers around the world, who make the decisions about whether this is done. It's only when something gets high profile, it gets flagged, it's got a lot of media attention, then maybe it'll go up to the chain. But most of these decisions get made in the dark, non-transparently, without any due process, and somewhat silently. And you know, none of these companies have sophisticated due process or other ways to make sure that they don't make a mistake in the first place, or if they do, there's a way to get it remedied. None of them have built that out. It's not really in their business interest to, which is why we think, just like the phone company should stay out of what you get to say on the phone, or the toll road should get out of the business of trying to decide whether you're a fleeing bank robber or just somebody going on their way, these deep infrastructure companies are not going to do a good job and really shouldn't be in the business of deciding who gets to speak and who doesn't.
Who should be deciding?
Well, I mean, the U.S. has a couple of mechanisms for taking the most extreme organizations and putting them in a no-go place, not just for internet hosting, but for any other things. The U.S. has a sanctions list. Right, you can't provide services to North Korea. You can't provide services to certain groups. I'm sure ISIS is on that list, for instance. So there is a very extreme, very small circle of things that we put beyond the pale, and we say you can't do business with these. But those mechanisms have not been triggered here, even though we're seeing what I think some people would rightly say is some pretty thuggish and awful behavior that may slide into definitions that would put them close to that situation. And I think what's going on here is these companies are rushing in to fill a void because we don't have the U.S. government and governmental forces dealing seriously with the actual violence that's happening. And so what's happening is these companies are stepping in and we're starting to talk more about their speech than about their actions. And I think those are both very dangerous.
Jonathan Vick, let me bring you in from the Anti-Defamation League. I'm wondering what you think of that analogy with the phone company, that the phone company shouldn't be involved in deciding who can say what on the phone. Do you see a distinction here with these internet companies?
Well, certainly we're not talking about, as with a phone company, point-to-point transmission conversations between individuals. We're really talking about a broadcast medium in a much more realistic way. Not that these companies should be prevented from carrying any of this content. We have worked with them for many years, and I have to take issue with Cindy's comment. I think in many cases they have studied this problem extensively over time in terms of hate speech, in terms of the impact, in terms of the victimization that is caused online, because they are very concerned with the ecology of the Internet and the environments they create. So they are not completely unqualified, and in many cases the policies that have been created for what is and isn't acceptable on their platforms have been created and discussed very high up in the organizations. Not that these are perfect situations. This is a very fluid environment. Daily Stormer is an outlier. Daily Stormer is an exceptional situation and has been for quite some time. But on average, we really feel that it is really the content base problem when there are individual posts, comments, threats, efforts to marginalize groups and victimize groups, that those are the things that take precedence over what's going on, and not necessarily blanket chasing somebody off the Internet wholesale.
Cindy?
Well, I think there are different kinds of companies at play here, and I want to make sure that I'm being very clear. The frontline, the user services like Facebook and Twitter and the parts of Google that are directly user-facing have been developing and do much better job now than they used to, but frankly still have a long way to go, and they're starting with trying to differentiate and not get played by organized groups that are complaining about people who they disagree with, and they still get played all the time.
Give an example of that.
So just this summer, Facebook used its hate speech policies to censor queer artists and activists for using words like dyke and fag. Because what do? They do banned words lists. Breastfeeding. Women who have been involved in breastfeeding forums, pictures of breastfeeding, explanations about latching and things like this. I have spent 17 years trying to make sure that women who want to talk about breastfeeding can do it on various forums. And it started long before Facebook even existed. It still goes because you have to understand context. You have to have a better understanding of things to make these decisions. Humans struggle to do it, and computers don't do it well at all.
So you're talking about basically like an algorithm that shuts these things down?
Sometimes it's humans and sometimes it's algorithms. Humans do a mediocre job of doing this, especially if they don't have training and they don't understand context. Algorithms and technologies are even worse. I'll give you a recent example. YouTube just recently proudly announced that they were using AI to try to flag and take down extremist content online.
Artificial intelligence.
Yeah, artificial intelligence. You know what they took down? They took down the picture of the Nazi sign coming down in Nuremberg after the war. They've taken down Syrian war crimes investigators, groups that are organizing to capture evidence of war crimes in Syria and post them on YouTube so that they get protected by YouTube's, you know, strong security and never going down, are getting themselves are getting flagged by these services as extremist content because it's hard to tell. And computers are really not good at this and aren't going to be good for a long time.
Jonathan, Vic, what are your thoughts about that sort of slippery slope or just mistakes being made in trying to, you know, clean up these sorts of extreme examples, but mistakes happening along the way? What are your concerns, if any?
Well, there's absolutely concerns. We've seen, as Cindy said, we've seen time and time again the exercise to institute AI or other types of forms of automated observation and filtering have gone awry. In part, that's because they are put in place and there is a human being programming behind all of this. So there is either an inherent bias or a potential for a flaw to occur there. But I would not dissuade companies who are morally motivated to try and improve what's going on from stopping any effort whatsoever from applying technology or staff or training or discussions and forums to arrive at the parameters for what is and isn't acceptable from doing so. You really need to encourage the public, and by public, you also talk about employees, you're talking about owners, you're talking about programmers and participants from voicing their opinion about what is going on in the environment online that we're all participating in.
Cindy Cohen?
I want to get to the second part of what I was saying so we're clear. I think there is an important difference between the companies that serve users directly, like Twitter and Facebook, and the infrastructure companies like Cloudflare, right, like the domain name servers, like certificate authorities, like payment processors. These companies, and they are never going to be able to or devote the resources here. It's not in their business interest to do it, and they'll screw it up. Excuse me, my language. They will not do it well.
It's not a banned word. Don't
it's
worry.
Not. They will not do it well. Funny, we're talking about banned words here. The direct line companies, the Twitters and the Facebook that really are the direct hosts of these kind of speech, they need to work hard to make sure that they're very careful and they have due process and they have things in place. But once you get up to the upper level infrastructure companies, they're going to make bigger mistakes. They're going to affect more people. We worked with a website where a complaint to about one article on a website called Cryptome. By Microsoft, that they were publishing something that they shouldn't be publishing, took the whole website offline because that's what the domain name host can do. It just, you couldn't go to the website at all.
It was a blunt tool.
It's a way overbroad blunt tool. And so these infrastructure companies, these deeper infrastructure upstream companies should not be doing this at all.
That's Cindy Cohen. She's executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She's with us this morning along with Jonathan Vick from the Anti-Defamation League and Hannah Kushla from Financial Times, a tech reporter with Financial Times. We're talking about tech companies facing pressure or, in fact, severing ties with hate groups. We'd love to hear from you this morning as well. Give us a ring at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Hannah, what kind of conversation is happening within these companies or among these companies as they wrestle with these things? What concerns do they have? And are they feeling – what kind of pressure are they facing?
Yeah, I think especially for the internet companies, the ones which aren't infrastructure, as Cindy was saying, the Facebooks and Twitters and Googles, over the last couple of years, this has really intensified as an issue. Twitter, for example, started to see fear that their traditional position as being the platform much more a freedom of speech than Facebook, for example, which has always said it's a walled garden, it has its policies. If you don't obey its policies, don't come on. Twitter's actually started to move in the direction of Facebook. It's, made many more tools to try and combat abuse on the platform because they thought that that was one of the things responsible for slowing user growth. So they thought it was hitting their business. So the other key point here is, after the US election last year, I think a lot of employees within these tech companies woke up the next morning and thought, oh my God, this company that I was drawn to because I felt they had this amazing mission and was going to transform the world is actually potentially doing quite a lot of damage. And I think that started a lot of conversations within the companies about how do we change the way that we engage with the world? How do we actually learn more about what's going on in the world?
You're talking more sort of about the fake news.
So yeah,
aspect.
I think it started with fake news. There were already stuff going underway, for example, on hate speech and terrorism. Especially, there's been a lot of pressure from countries in the EU, from governments there. But I think that the fake news stuff sort of spread out, and people were very worried about the influence of fake news. But they then became very worried about the use, for example, of Facebook Live this year. We've seen a lot of that. Filming murders on Facebook Live. And so I think within the companies, the leadership are facing pressure to show that they can't hide behind this defense that they've always had, which is we're a tech company, not a media company. We just provide the wires. We can't do anything about it.
All right. Let's allow some of our listeners to weigh in here. Ben asks, internet speech is free, but Facebook speech is not. If hate groups want to say what they want, they just have to go somewhere else. It's a business, not a utility. What do you think of that distinction, Cindy?
Well, I think that it's true as far as it goes. I think that, if Facebook does have the right to decide who gets to be on Facebook and who doesn't, I think Facebook is big enough and important enough that I'm nervous because I think we need to develop more alternative places for speak. There's a concern we have that some of these companies handle so much of the speech on the internet that what they say ends up being de facto whether you get to speak or not. And to me, the answer to that is to have more social networks, more choices, more places, so that getting kicked off of Facebook doesn't mean that you don't get to talk to any of your relatives anymore. It may mean that you get to vote with your feet and use another service. And I think that will encourage Facebook and a lot of these other companies to step up rather than step back.
All right, let's go to the phones. And Casey in Pleasant Hill, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having this conversation. The guest you had on yesterday from Cloudflare, I thought you played the clip where he drew the analogy with somebody listening in on our phone calls and deciding that they were going to take away our phone service. I don't think that's the right analogy. I think we're talking more about a broadcast medium, and I think we should be looking to the regulations that we've implemented in other forms of communication as a potential model for helping guide us here.
Yeah, and I think thanks for the comment. I think an earlier there was an earlier comment to that effect as well. So I'm wondering, you know, we're in this moment where in some ways the White House is not helping this situation. They're fanning the flames. You know, if this were a different kind of administration, Cindy, would you expect that there would be more guidance coming from the federal government in this regard?
I think that's right. I mean, there's no congressional hearings. I mean, it's not just the president. There, you know, the violence that's happening on the ground does not have a strong official response to it. And again, I think that's partially why people are looking at the speech, because we're not seeing any real reaction to violence. It feels like we're kind of powerless to stop these thugs from coming into our town and beating people up. And so people are looking for things that they can do. And I think that that's a big difference. In terms of a broadcast medium, I just want to note, I'm nervous about using that distinction to mean that there ought to be, I mean, the way that we handle speech in the broadcast area is that the government regulates it. There are government agencies that decide what words you can say on the radio. You know, depending on who's in charge of the government, you know, that could be more dangerous, right? That could bring the real levers of power, the governmental power, throwing people in jail to bear on these decisions. And I think if you're nervous about the fact that the government isn't taking a strong position against hate now, why would you want to empower the government to have an even bigger role in what gets said on the internet?
We're coming up to a break, but Hannah, I'm wondering if you heard anything. You know, how does Twitter feel about the tweeter in chief getting so much attention with his use of Twitter? I mean, it's controversial.
So Twitter as a company has been very quiet on the issue. They've faced a lot of calls, actually, from users to ban the president because, you know, certain of his tweets could be seen as breaking some of their terms and conditions. And I think that we can be pretty sure that they're not going to do that.
I can't see that happening. All right. Well, much more to talk about, and we already have people on the lines waiting to weigh in, but there are some open phone lines. Give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions and comments to forum@kqed.org or leave us a comment on our Facebook page as well. We're talking about what tech companies should do, if anything, to minimize the kind of hate speech, extreme speech that we're hearing about and reading about on the internet. And all this, of course, happening as two big rallies are planned for the Bay Area, which is only going to elevate this issue further. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today with Michael for Michael Krasny. Stick around. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this hour we're talking about hate speech on the internet and tech companies' efforts to sever ties with some of these hate groups and the slippery slope some see in their doing that. My guests are Hannah Kushla. She's a tech reporter with the Financial Times. Cindy Cohen is executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And Jonathan Vick, joining us by phone, associate director for cyber hate response at the Anti-Defamation League. If you want to join us, the number is 866-733-6786. And let's get started with Brooke in San Mateo. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. I specifically want to thank Cindy for all the work that she's done. And I think what makes America great, actually, currently, is the unusual situation that we have with free speech and privacy, First Amendment rights. I am no fan of hate speech, and I think we have to call out the purveyors of hate speech for what they are. But unless there are actual threats, I think we have to be tremendously vigilant with allowing people to say whatever they want to say. It's what allows us to be the country that we are. Obviously, private companies can do what they want to do, but we're going to watch the infrastructure of the internet grow over the next couple of decades, and it's not going to be government. It's going to be us. It's going to be the users and grassroots and the people who set the parameters.
Thanks, Brooke, for that comment. Jonathan Vick, I'm wondering what you think about that. And also, you know, someone pointed out that being a Nazi is illegal in Germany, but they still have Nazi rallies. I mean, what's the practical effect of censoring some of these organizations?
Well, there will always be a place for them to go. There will always be a niche for them to occupy. There will always be hosting companies or platforms that will welcome them. If Facebook, Twitter, or Google, anyone else has policies that restrict them from being there or make it a hostile environment for them, they will go to VK. They will find a Reddit. They will find an 8chan where they can socialize, or a new company will emerge. That has been the nature of what's gone on the internet. Talking to the point the caller made is that in terms of, yes, when there is threatening content, when threats are made and people need to respond and there needs to be an official response, the question is that there are things that are considered threatening that do not necessarily meet the legal definition of a threat. And that is where we start to get into the gray area here that becomes so problematic.
Here's a comment from Siddhartha, who writes, should U.S. corporations have continued doing business with Nazi Germany? Would we ask such a question? Mark writes, draw the line at performing or advocating illegal activity. Even there, there's a fine line between wishing someone dead and urging it, discussing child pornography and promoting it. Cindy Cohn, very complex and nuanced issues. And as you said at the beginning, who should decide? Who should be empowered to do that?
Well, I mean, in the context of the original Third Reich, there were prosecutions for companies that actively, knowingly helped the Third Reich. And in fact, EFF has filed amicus briefs in support of holding companies liable for knowing direct co-conspirator relationships with that. But that's a very different place to be in than simply providing services to the world and somebody uses your services to do something bad. And, you know, I've filed briefs in many courts in the United States kind of explaining the difference between the two. It goes all the way back to Nuremberg. There's a clear line. Well, clear. There's a set of legal decisions about what the difference is. And I think that those differences matter. I think that simply, even a hammer can be used to hit somebody over the head. We don't hold the people who create hammers responsible. However, we do hold the people who built and shipped Zyklon gas to the gas chambers responsible. We can draw those lines. They're important ones to draw. But to me, they turn a lot on the actual activities and not so much on the speech, because speech is harder to be able to make those distinctions.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Darrow in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hey, good morning. I have been seeing a lot of the planning that went into Charlottesville by the alt-right on these social media sites, talking about how to avoid felonies while still bringing tons of weapons, and how is the organizing of terrorist groups any different from allowing the we don't want to, you know, allow them to organize online, so why should we let the alt-right organize online?
Cindy?
Well, I think that there are laws and rules in place around weapons and other things that are, frankly, not being very well enforced. I do think that and there are lists. There's a U.S. sanctions list about places where you can't do business because these people have been determined after careful evaluation by people in the State Department who are specialists in the area about who should be on these lists. They get it wrong sometimes, too, and I'm very nervous about that. But I think having free range people deciding who gets to speak and who doesn't get to speak, you're going to end up with causes you love being targeted. There have been efforts to try to call Black Lives Matter a terrorist group. There have been efforts to try to call some of the Antifa groups, the anti-fascist groups, terrorist groups. We have to be really careful about these things. And again, I think the reason that people are feeling a need to do this is because our government isn't stepping in when violence happens and using the tools that are already at its disposal to try to prevent violence, prevent people from getting hurt, prevent people from getting killed.
All right, Daryl, thanks for the call. Let's go now to San Anselmo. Justin, welcome.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Long-time listener, first-time caller. But yes, it seems like the fundamental thing that people are going back and forth about is kind of the difference between the First Amendment and property rights. It's like, does a company essentially have the right to deplatform anybody they want? I don't like to call it censorship because I usually think of censorship with the government. But it's like, yeah, like these people do have their property rights, and there's also – there are alternatives, as the gentleman from the ADL said, the Gab and – 8chan, 4chan, et cetera. So, I mean, how do you guys got to go with the whole thing of who's going to win the property rights or free speech kind of? It's interesting as a more liberty-minded.
Yeah. Cindy, do you see that as the sort of the trade-off or the question?
Well, I think it takes you to a very specific place, which is these companies have the right to decide who they want to do business with. But we urge them to be very, very careful. And the bigger they are, the more market power they have, the fewer alternatives there are, the more responsibility they have to be extremely careful in these kinds of decisions, because if they get it wrong, the consequences can be really dire. And again, if you think that those consequences are only going to fall on causes you hate and are never going to fall on causes you love, you haven't been – you know, you take a look at my docket for the last 17 years. It's all across the board.
Justin, thanks for the call. Hannah, I'm wondering the extent to which, you know, these companies make money, a lot of these companies, from advertising. Mm-hmm. Some of these hate group ads, for example, can pop up on your feed, making money both for the group and for Google. I mean, how are these companies thinking about that aspect of it, the financial aspect?
So I think overall they are quite cautious to not look like they're making money off them. I think that advertisers is a huge pressure group that we actually haven't touched upon here, which is, you know, one of the reasons why internet companies are very worried is that they are not, you know, they have property rights because they make money off their property by selling it to advertisers. We saw earlier in the year YouTube facing a lot of advertisers withdrawing just because of the being juxtaposed next to content that they didn't like. And so I think everyone is on edge that the advertisers are getting power, you know, very powerful in this situation. And I also think that, you know, we talked earlier about, you know, whether there was a vacuum of leadership from the White House. Actually, what we have seen in the last few days since Charlottesville as well is a lot of corporate America stepping up. We've seen a lot of CEOs from all these manufacturing groups and different councils stepping down, saying, I can't be part of this. I can't look like I endorse this. And I think that the internet companies' actions should be read within that context.
To what extent, I mean, these companies largely are based in a very liberal part of the country. A lot of their workers are Democrats or liberal, not all of them, of course. But to what extent is that driving it? In other words, they're hearing from their workers about this.
Definitely. And in fact, you know, only the week before we saw Google starting to be targeted by members of the alt-right after they fired the employee, James DeMore, who wrote a memo sort of criticizing their diversity policies. And, you know, lots of Google employees was targeted by the alt-right. And so it has been set up as sort of Silicon Valley versus the alt-right. And so I think that's a huge influence.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones again. The number to call, 866-733-6786. And let's go to Carlos in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. Really quick, I have a comment regarding Facebook, but then I just wanted to address really quickly just an extremely misleading comment that was made during the last segment regarding the Ford Go bikes. Emily had said that
you know what? I'm sorry. We moved on. If you want to leave a comment about that, I encourage you to go to the Facebook page, to the web page, and leave a comment. But we've moved on. I apologize for that. If you have a question about this topic, feel free to send us an email. Okay, Carlos, I guess you do have a question about this topic. So if you want to get that in, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. I just know you pride yourself on being fair and balanced news. But regarding this topic specifically,
okay.
I want to talk about Facebook's obligation regarding data mining. only in the sense that, you know, I heard that there are groups that are able to data mine certain keywords from people's Facebook groups once those people like certain group pages and whatnot. And then they'll go ahead and take those keywords to create posts for these people to further perpetuate their beliefs. So providing along the line of fake news. And so, you know, is there anything, one, that Facebook can do to protect against this sort of data mining? And then number two, you know, should they have an obligation to go and find these kind of posts that are providing misleading news, utilizing only keywords to individual Facebook posts and remove those from Facebook and not necessarily limiting people's access to these communications?
Cindy?
Well, I think that there are lots of really important questions about Facebook's basic business model, which is to try to know everything about you so that they can keep you on Facebook as long as possible. And there's some serious ethical concerns about the way that they have designed their system to try to keep you on Facebook for as long as possible.
We talked about that for an hour yesterday.
Yeah. And I think that those are really important questions. And this is a subset of those, right? This is, you know, third parties getting access to that information and then reusing it to try to reinforce people's biases. That's in Facebook's interest because it's all happening on Facebook. So I think there's a lot of ethical questions that we need to ask here. There's a lot of privacy questions that we've raised serious concerns with Facebook about how this model works and the kind of degree of intrusion, you know, the degree of really tracking and profiling people that's made possible here. And of course, once you track and profile people, you can make custom messages that try to keep them on Facebook. I think there's a really important and topic, a little different from this one, but it kind of goes to the general question about these companies and their responsibilities to us as humans, not just the product they're selling.
All right, Carlos, thanks for the call. Let's go now to San Jose. And Kristen, you're on.
Your guest a few minutes ago made a moral equivalency between Nazis and white supremacists with Black Lives Matter and the so-called anti-fascists. Those anti-fascists and certainly Black Lives Matter are not looking to kill anybody and get rid of anybody, whereas white supremacists and Nazis, that is their whole reason for being.
Yeah. And Kristen, that's certainly a valid point. Cindy, I think she's referring to a point you were making, but you were saying that some people feel that Black Lives Matter. And I've heard people at the Republican convention tell me that they are a hate group. They are a terror group. It's not something you were saying, but you were quoting the views of others.
Yeah, not at all. I don't think that they're equivalent at all. And I'm sorry if that was the impression that you received. What I meant to say is this tactic can be used and is being used against causes that you love along with causes that you hate. And you have to be careful about embracing the tactic because right now it's being used against something you hate because the tactic itself is much older and is much more consistently used against causes that maybe you love, maybe you don't love, but causes that are not neo-Nazis. And that's the danger in embracing the tactic instead of looking at the underlying activities and going after those.
Kristen, does that clear it up for you?
No. I think if people in Nazi Germany had stood up and started it's absolutely ridiculous to say that those causes that we love are going to be treated.
Well, I think the point is not everybody loves all the same groups. And, you know,
no, of course not. But some are very dangerous. And some are just saying, are trying to say something that is reasonable and is what Americans should stand for.
Well, again, and I appreciate the thought, but people have different points of view about what folks say about police officers and, you know, one person's police brutality is another person's, you know, they see that as the police standing up for public safety. So I'm not taking a stand on that. I'm just saying that there's a wide spectrum of views. And I think, Cindy, what you're saying is it is, you know, this slippery slope that if you may not like what the white supremacists are saying, but, you know, tomorrow they may come for Black Lives Matter.
And I think that if you're asking the tech companies to be the ones who are the deciders here, you're going to be disappointed in their ability to do this because they won't do it well. And, you know, again, I have utmost respect for Matthew Prince, but I think he was completely correct to say, I shouldn't be the person who's deciding who gets to speak and who doesn't get to speak, because maybe I'm right here, but I won't be right every single time.
That's the CEO of Cloudflare. Correct. Although clearly trying to have it both ways. Right, Anna?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that it was...
Look what I've done. It's terrible.
It was good that he called out this conflict and he didn't take it for granted. I think a lot of the time when we have these discussions, these companies, they say, this is our policy and end of. We're not going to talk about it. We're not going to work out whether us sitting on, you know, the edge of the West Coast are the right people to create rules which are going to apply all around the world. You know, this is also not a Silicon Valley versus the US government who should make the rules argument. This is something that's going to apply in every different country and very different context that a lot of people here won't understand.
Jonathan Vick, this point that was made about Daily Stormer going now into the deep web where they can't be maybe accessed as easily but also can't be monitored as easily. What concerns does your group, the Anti-Defamation League, have about that? Is there something to be said for having these groups more out in the open?
Well, first, we would never advocate, as what happened with the Daily Stormer, that it be completely delisted, that it not receive registration support. We've never asked for contact in ICANN or any registrar in terms of delisting or desupporting an organization. In terms of so in that regard, they certainly deserve a place on the at the podium. The question is about what is indeed said once they are there. Daily Stormer absolutely has had content that is threatening and dangerous by absolutely any definition. And a lot of the other content there is not. This is a very common way that the right wing uses and the extremists use the internet, is they will mix in political discussions with outright threatening lines of thought and essays. And so they're entitled to be there. It's then a matter of stepping up and using your voice and using free expression to call out the things in those different places that are problematic.
All right, let's get some more listener comments. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. We've got some online comments. Brian writes, it's so easy for folks who aren't the target of this hate speech to say, yes, let's keep them advocating genocide. Wah writes, how does Title II regulation for internet infrastructure companies play into this? Hannah, do you know, or Cindy, what he's referring to there, Title II regulation?
Title II, he's talking about network neutrality. The network neutrality debate is extremely important. I don't think it plays into this very much because it's not about content discrimination of communications. It's about whether ISPs and other internet providers can essentially hold their customers hostage and say, you know, nice list you got there, Craig. It'd be a shame if something happened to us. You better pay us money and we'll make sure Craigslist loads. You can see some overlap on the edges, but in the main, they're a bit different.
All right, let's go back to the phones and we go to Atlanta, Georgia. Jim, welcome.
Hi, thank you. A couple of quick comments. One, while I understand, you know, the focus on preventing people from distributing hate speech, there's an underlying problem that needs to be addressed, is that there's recent psychological studies that show the more people hear an opposing viewpoint, the harder they get into hardening into their viewpoint. So until we address how to get people to listen and have a dialogue, simply stopping them from speaking is just going to play into their hands of this vast conspiracy against them, and we're right, and people don't want you to know about this.
Jonathan, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off, Jim. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. That's really all I had to say.
Okay, well, thanks. It's an interesting point. Jonathan Vick, to what extent does the ADL try to facilitate conversations? And, you know, even among very extreme points of view, it can be difficult, especially now. People are really siloed in many cases.
Well, we absolutely advocate that people use their voices. That is all part of the free speech equation. Just as you allow the owner's speech, the ability to comment against the owner's speech is part of the privilege and part of the obligation of people. We've seen in the past weeks people using their voices and speaking up. We engage ongoing on an ongoing basis with other agencies that we don't necessarily share common cause with on issues that surrounding current events, and with the internet industry itself, with platforms whose policies we don't necessarily agree with, to try and come to some sort of better understanding of our position and their position.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. Again, the number is 866-733-6786. Michael in Moraga, you're next.
Hey, yeah, I just think we don't need to police free speech anymore. We just have to basically punish those who break the law. I think that's just the simplest thing. People don't see people who, for example, the guy who killed the lady in Charlottesville, he got second-degree murder charge. He should have got murder one. And those online who was egging him on to do this should all be prosecuted to the fully extent of the law. I think that just making examples of other people who break the law would stifle stupid behavior.
All right. Cindy Cohen, what are your thoughts? I mean, obviously, those kinds of things do get prosecuted, but there are some gray areas, whether or not somebody's inciting something online, and, you know, they're not all prosecutable, certainly.
That's right. But I do think that the caller is fundamentally right, which is we really need a stronger government response to the actual acts of violence and intimidation that are happening. There were people who got beat up the night before in Charlottesville. I don't know what the status is of those prosecutions. Why aren't we hearing about those? Why aren't we hearing about serious prosecutions about people who are actually committing violence, committing threats in people's faces? If there's a conspiracy or some kind of incitement, that's a pretty high standard. But it might be able to be met. I mean, the government is certainly right now in a situation that I think is one that people who are happy about the Daily Stormer situation ought to watch a little bit. The government is prosecuting a lot of the people who protested on Inauguration Day, the so-called J20 protesters, and they are claiming that they all incited a riot and that they fomented and planned a riot, and they've subpoenaed the ISP to try to get information about all the people. First, all the people who visited the website, now a subset of those who were involved in planning the protest, but the government called that a riot, and they're prosecuting the people under the anti-riot statutes. So it's not like the government isn't taking action against protesters. They're picking and choosing which ones they're taking action against, and that's the thing that I think we ought to be focused on.
All right, back to the phones. Palo Alto is our next stop. Ali, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, go right ahead.
My question, I'm in agreement here. Essentially, we talk about net neutrality. What if ISPs start to throttle access to basically far-right groups? Are we suddenly okay with that? Are we going to diminish net neutrality? Because this seems like it's very similar, where we're essentially just siding with what appeals to us now, when in reality we should probably have something more public, like a government regulating basically entity that takes care of it rather than just leaving it in the hands of private companies.
Yeah, and certainly that point's been made. Jonathan Vick, what are your thoughts about that?
Well,
and are you working with the government, and have you noticed a change, for example, in their responsiveness?
We offer information to the government, and when we're asked opinions on particular issues, we certainly put together papers for various members of the houses of government. But we have a great deal of concern about government regulation in this area. We've seen in Europe how it's gone right and how it's gone wrong. Very often government regulation is a response to public outcry, which is not necessarily fully considered process of what the law should consist of. And you don't want a reactionary law instituted. You want a considered law instituted and something that is enforceable, actionable, and reasonable. And that is a very difficult process, and we have concerns about that.
Hannah Kushla, are you hearing from companies who would like the government to maybe give them more guidance so they don't have to make these decisions? Generally, Silicon Valley is more libertarian than that. They don't really want government involved.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting conflict for them because traditionally they haven't wanted government involved at all. And as I said earlier, in Europe, they are starting to have them involved on some things to do with hate speech, to do with encryption, to do with tracking terrorists. And they are they're trying to deal with that in a sort of traditionally, you know, big company way, which is to try and get out in front of it, to try and look like or show that they are making moves and guidance and employing more people on these things, rather than, you know, get hit by strict regulation. So here in the U.S., we haven't seen any requests for regulation.
All right, let's go see if we can get another call in before the end of the hour. Ryan in Berkeley, you're next.
Hi, is this me?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to say one thing. I think the slippery slope comment couldn't be farther from the truth. I think there is a clear line between genocide and ethnic cleansing and everything else that's going on. So if Black Lives Matter decided they wanted to promote wiping out race, a race, or murdering people, I think you'd have an argument there to take them off as well. And so the other point I wanted to make is that we should empower CEOs to be able to make legitimate moral calls, because they have to sleep at night, and you know it's a stretch to think the government is going to take over anytime soon and actually do the right thing as well. The government doesn't always get it right either.
Yeah, thanks very much, Brian, for that. Although, Cindy, as you were saying, it isn't the CEOs who are making these decisions. I'm sort of shocked, actually, that what you said at the very beginning, that it's often – I think you said minimum wage employees making some of these decisions?
That's the vast majority of these decisions. This situation has gotten onto the headlines and the front loads and up to the CEOs because of the – well, frankly, because of the murder and the intense pressure. But these – especially Facebook and YouTube and Twitter make these decisions about who gets to speak and who doesn't, who gets kicked off, whose websites you can get to all the time, quietly and prominently. CEOs already have the power to decide who they want to do business with. That's not going to change anytime soon. What we're really urging them to do, though, is to not wade into these kinds of waters unless they're going to really do the hard work of making sure they get it right.
And Hannah, real quickly, we're coming to the end, but what are you looking for going forward? Are companies going to continue being embroiled in these kinds of issues, I guess?
I think they have to look for a way where they're not doing it on a case-by-case basis and getting in the headlines every time.
All right. That'll be the last word. Hannah Kushla from Financial Times, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to Cindy Cohen from the Electronic Frontier Foundation and to Jonathan Vick, Associate Director for Cyber Hate Response at the Anti-Defamation League. Thanks to all of you very much. Appreciate it. And that concludes this hour of Forum. Thanks so much for listening and for all the great comments and questions you sent our way. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny, and I'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.